Well, to get going, what I was thinking, speaking a bit tonight, was looking at the lower left quadrant, what that means in recovery, specifically focusing on practices, and also a bit about what that means from a context of addiction, why not just understanding that lower left practices are important, but also understanding a little bit on why it is important. And I've always said that I think out of all the dimensions of recovery or sustainable recovery process, the lower left, I think, is probably the most important, or certainly the most essential one. I think if one had to do research on that and see what is the common factor amongst people that tend to stay clean, whether they're in 12 steps or not or whatever, I think one of the probably the most common variables would be some form of supportive network or community. What do you guys think about that?
Well, definitely for me, one of the reasons I use drugs, alcohol, or food was to comfort myself. And what I find is having community, and I have a variety of them now, I've gradually built them up, is it replaces that. I get great comfort from my connection, even online, because I have groups online that that are just incredibly supportive. So, yeah, for me, it really is. And I got to say, that quadrant, without me doing my inner work on my thinking, I would have a lot of connection, but a lot of insane mind, too. So I wouldn't necessarily say for me, because I have a lot of beliefs that just run me, that upper left quadrant isn't equally important. But boy, without that lower left one, I isolate and I can get really, my mind can get really crazy. So it really affects that upper left quadrant to where I have no context. You know, yeah. I start to think I'm the craziest person in the world. And then when I'm in connection with people, I find out, oh, we all have those crazy thoughts, or we all have that. You know, so it's very nurturing to me to be connected to people, and it prevents me from isolating and getting hermit crazy.
Yeah, sure.
Well, for me, I would just say one of my current mantras is, we can't do it alone. And I'm just becoming increasingly aware, both personally and culturally. I have a sense that the next place we're going culturally is to that sense of connection and sense that we can't do it alone. And when I look at spiral dynamics, I see us swinging there. We've been so long in this individually oriented kind of me culture. And now just learning, again, personally, and as I look around me, that this is something we need to do together, not in isolation. It doesn't work any longer in isolation.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, Victoria. I think one of the things that people are coming around to is that the idea that anybody can exist independently is an illusion anyway. There's no such thing as an independent individual in any way whatsoever. And I think with guys like Heidegger, sort of some of the existentialists of the last century, started bringing those ideas more to the foreground, where in the past it was very much seen as an object, as a subject acting as on an object. So you were subject and you're acting on different objects in the world, and these objects influence your subjectivity and, you know, all sorts of things, but it was still a very clear dichotomy. And something that Ken Wilber stresses very often, he actually uses Heidegger's being in the world very often throughout all his writing, is that what Heidegger and Wilber points out is that there is no such thing as our being as human beings is in the world. There is no such thing as being that is in any way separate from the world. Being can't exist outside of the world. At any given moment, anything we think or do or say or, you know, am in any way is always related to some extent to the world, and that relation is influenced by the world. So while I find the lower left quadrant important, isn't so much, you know, it's not so much about, you know, hanging out in groups the whole time from a social perspective. I mean, that is important. But the lower left quadrant is the thing that creates one's upper left quadrant. You know, it's not the other way around. And if one looks at children, you know, really the first couple of years of your life, you know, anybody that has children, I mean, your child will only speak about the things that he encounters. You know, you don't get a three-year-old that all of a sudden starts speaking in a different language or starts speaking about, you know, some philosophy or art that they've never encountered. You know, everything that they are is really their environment. And self-object relation theorists and those guys point out that, you know, the self of, you know, as children go up, their self is entirely dependent on these relationships between the objects outside of themselves, especially their primary caregivers and the caregivers in the world, and the things that surrounds them. So they, you know, there is no real, you know, in that way one can see that the upper left quadrant has virtually got no existence apart from a potential which is purely dependent on the lower left quadrant and obviously the lower right quadrant to a large extent, because that provides the infrastructure for these things to happen in, like the building of the school provides the place for the school, and the school provides the material which influences the kids' upper left quadrant. and especially with addicts, a lot of the etiology of many people's addictions is found in the lower left quadrant, especially at a very young age due to issues, family issues and cultural issues and social issues, that influences one's very basic view of the world and view of oneself, and view of other people. And all those views aren't something that the child, you know, sits on a rock in isolation and philosophizes about and comes to certain conclusions. These are just views that the child just in many ways passively absorbs, obviously through their own uniqueness in some way. But most children will experience the same environment in very similar ways. So until they develop any form of self-awareness or self-insight, everything they know and everything they are is pretty much their environment. And if one experienced any distress at that age, then that is going to become one's upper left sort of perspective of the world. And eventually one then thinks, this is the way the world and your culture caused you to view the world, not that is the way you view it. You were basically trained to view that. Not least in later life, one can start changing that. So what's really important for me from a recovery perspective is that, you know, if one looks at recovery, let's say there's so many different angles to this thing, but one of the very common perspective is, which I think is a lot of validity to, is the idea that recovery is a very shame-based disorder, that at the root of addiction, there's this feeling of inadequacy, or there's something broken, or there's something not quite right with one, and the sort of addictive behavior that one develops late in life is in a way an attempt to try and rectify this sort of pervasive feeling of shame, which is really a feeling of I'm not good enough in some ways. And that feeling of shame, that's not something anybody is born with. That's something that one is taught, you know, through not consciously or in those words, but that is one's experience of the world in the way that one experiences oneself in relation to other people primarily, and how those people makes one feel about oneself pretty much. And I think what's significant to me, and also the guys that take that a bit further, like Philip Flores or somebody that really views addiction as an attachment disorder, which ties in with this idea of shame and what the sort of self-object relations guys have to say about addiction and all those things, is that fundamentally addiction is seen as a dysfunctional attachment pattern. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because that spans the lower left and lower right, upper left quadrants, and obviously relevance in the other two quadrants. But from an attachment disorder perspective, is really what addicts have internalized at some stage of their life, most likely at sort of a pre-verbal stage, is that getting attached to people is a dangerous or tricky business for some reason. Therefore, you know, everyone has attachment needs. Everyone has a need for connection, a need for belonging, a need for love, care, etc. But if one finds it difficult to have those needs met through people, and one is mistrustful of that process, then because those needs has to be met in some way, what many people in childhood that are prone to addiction in later life will start feeling is that if I have a need for care and I can't get it from people, then I still need to get it. So I'm going to look for it in other means. And a safe way to get that, not a very sustainable way, but a very effective in the short term, is through inanimate objects that you can control. And that's why very often at the central mechanism of addiction is the need to control, because one is mistrustful of one's environment. And if you're mistrustful of your environment, then it's not something that you want to be at the mercy of. You would prefer to control that. So, you know, the sort of proto, you know, archaic root of addiction, and I'm saying for all people, but for many people, is the inability to form healthy attachments with people. But because attachment is a very profound need, they will seek to find attachment with objects. When I say objects, you know, behaviors, and whether it's drugs, alcohol, sex, or gambling, or work, whatever, that they can control. That's within their means to achieve, and they can control. And that type of attachment is very appealing to somebody that has deficits in their capacity to attach to normal human beings, which are very mercurial creatures and unpredictable and virtually impossible to control. So what, you know, why I'm saying this as well is that I think once one starts looking at it from this perspective, which in many ways is pretty much common sense in a way, is one starts seeing the reason why healthy relationships in recovery is so important. And it's not about just in the social context of, you know, let me go for social functions with people, and let me have a community where I can sort of hang out, but a community in the sense where one can develop a very profound bond to, especially with individual people, Because what a lot of the sort of attachment theorists and these guys would say is that if there's a disorder of attachment, the only way that disorder can ever rectify itself is through sort of relearning it actually in new relationships. So one can't sit in, you can't sit and read a book or meditate or whatever in isolation and reprogram one's, attachment style. That just can't happen because you need an other for that. So in that context, if one sees it from that perspective, the only way an addict can then get better, if that's one of his issues, which I think for most people it is in some way, is the sort of slow reprogramming of this dysfunctional attachment pattern through actual relationships. And this isn't a pattern that's going to change over a week or two or due to some insight or a good book or whatever. These attachment patterns can only really slowly be rewired, I think, over a fairly extensive period of time. And there might be other things that speed it up, and all sorts of stuff. But the human, consistent human interaction, is really the ground where this can happen. So from a lower left perspective, as far as recovery goes, and that's what I said earlier, is that the people that seem to get better are people that, for whatever reason, find a fellowship or group of people. It doesn't necessarily have to be a recovery fellowship. I think any fellowship or group of people that is supportive or sustainable, whether it's family or an outside or whatever, that provides the person opportunity to form a healthy attachment that's based on trust, and also based on a realistic understanding of what human relationships are, that it's, you know, that it's up and down, and it's not something you can control, and it's not always pleasant, and all these types of things. When they develop these relationships over an extended period of time, that has a profound effect on the underlying dynamic of addiction, which in many ways can be understood as a way to have these attachment needs met. And when you're having your attachment needs met in a healthy way, then your desire to have these attachment needs met in an unhealthy way is going to be severely diminished. And I think that's one of the reasons why 12-step fellowships have been so effective. You know, I've always said that even if the 12 steps, you know, practice juggling or, you know, like, it, you know, regardless of what the actual program was, although I think the program has got a lot of good things in it, but regardless of what the program was, why they're so effective for so many people is that they just provide these extensive opportunities to make good friendships and good relationships, whether it's through sponsoring, whether it's through service, whether it's through just participation, whether it's going for a coffee afterwards, whether it's going to, you know, all these type of things, and just meeting like-minded people. And I think that's one of its main efficacy. So for me, when I work with somebody from a coaching or therapy perspective, one of the first things I'll always look out for, and one of the first things that I will base my prognosis on, is this person's willingness or even capacity to make an attempt to connect with people and the infrastructure that's actually available for them. If they're going back to their, you know, same environment, whether it's a small town or whether they're isolated in a city or whatever, without these very supportive social systems, I think really the chance of sustainable recovery is significantly diminished. So let me sort of just finish in that way. So like I said earlier, what's important for me is about the lower left quadrant isn't so much the lower left quadrant as seen as an isolated area or isolated practice, but actually the importance that the lower left has on the upper left, because it's in the upper left where the recovery stuff happens. You know, it happens within yourself. But the thing that has the most effect on oneself, I think in this particular context is fellowship. And like you were saying earlier, Lisa, especially if one's head is full of nonsense. And, you know, if anybody, if there's a group of people whose heads are full of like extreme nonsense, putting it politely, and that's the addict population, you know, as an addict, one's thoughts are all over the show, and it's one's capacity to perceive reality is really limited in many ways. So if one isn't going to find outside influence and opinions to try and rectify these dysfunctional ways of viewing oneself in the world, the chance of one doing it on one own, by oneself, with one's own default thinking and opinions, you know, it's like trying to pull yourself up by your own shoelaces. It's just very, very unlikely. So let me leave it there for as a preamble. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have lots of questions. It's Lisa. Yeah. Are you getting an echo?
I'm not getting an echo now.
Okay.
Okay.
Would you say then, though, that it's essential that the group, are you seeing that, or do you believe that it's essential that the group be a group of addicts necessarily in recovery? That's essential for recovery.
Yeah. I won't say that's essential, because I've seen people clean up in environments that isn't necessarily a recovery based group. I've seen people clean up in religious communities that's got nothing to do with recovery. I've seen people that's cleaned up that have just got very supportive families as well, or friends some people clean up because they get married and form new relationships with their partner and their support system, etc. Although I do believe that in many ways is the exception, and those people tend to have a fair amount of resilience before they do that. I think for a large percentage of addicts, they would probably need a community that is informed about addiction. And why I say that, I don't think it's so much about that the community needs to be informed about addiction, is that for many addicts, they feel so alienated from the world and society, is that I think this certainly doesn't go for everyone, you know, at all, but I think for certainly a certain percentage, I think there's very few communities or fellowships that they would join and really immediately feel a strong connection with. You know, your average sort of street heroin addict isn't going to join the chess club and immediately feel a sense of brotherhood or connection, or join the local, you know, badminton club or whatever. You know, there aren't really that many places where especially culturally meshed addicts can just walk in and connect with, you know. Firstly, they're not really going to be welcome in sort of most places, in that sense. And secondly, they won't feel any sense of immediate connection. Because also, there's also a very shallow side to community and culture. You know, as far as I'm concerned, general culture is a very shallow thing. General communities and groups of people are fairly shallow environments. That's one of the reasons that addiction is such a problem, is that the type of culture and socializations that the world offers are, you know, I don't think contains enough depth to provide people with their attachment needs. So that's the added problem, is that, you know, where would most addicts find, you know, these groups of people that they would form these connections with. So I think from a pragmatic point of view, it would probably, you know, theoretically make sense that for most people, it would be a sort of recovery type community where they, like, say in some recovery communities, it's a kinship of suffering. So it's like somebody that's had post-traumatic stress disorder. If he goes to a meeting with 20 other Vietnam vets or Afghanistan vets, he's immediately going to feel some sense of connection there, some sense of brotherhood, compared to if he walked into, just a meditation group or something. Does that answer your question, Lisa?
Yeah, it does actually. It seems to me, especially in the beginning, it's like that first year I had to find at least a clan that didn't ostracize me. Also, one of the counselors at when I went to treatment years ago, he's also a physicist and addiction counselor, and he shared with me a study, I think it was out of Johns Hopkins, where they measured the brain waves of people in a 12-step meeting and people coming in, and that they actually began to entrain to each other. And yeah. I don't remember the whole study, but the bottom line of it seemed to be that it didn't matter what went on in the room.
Yeah.
So much that it was, it entrained everybody to a different vibration, I think it was theta or something. Yeah. It was something, a much more meditative vibration. So people got the benefit just of being in the room together with other people who had the same issue going on, it seemed. And the only other thing I would say is, though, for me, I had to go. After the first year of that, for me, I had to find a group of people that I continued to identify with, and I didn't really continue to identify that well in the 12-step groups. So no big deal. I just found, it was a big deal because I had indoctrinated myself to believe that no other groups were of any value and that I would die a slow, torturous death if I left 12-step groups. That's what I told myself. But when I finally gave myself permission and found other, put together other support systems that worked for me, that was important too. So, it was important for me to see where I wasn't resonating anymore and make sure that I found where I did.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I agree with that entirely. So any social, if one joins the 12-step, being ostracized not by the people but by one's own incapacity to connect with them, then that the society doesn't become healthy for one. Then one needs to find a group of people or system where that is possible. And I think also as one matures, it's like being a kid. When you're a child, you need a lot of friends, and when you're a teenager, you need your whole group. And when you get older, you don't really want to be hanging out in like groups of 10 people anymore,
Yeah.
It's like pretty, I find it excruciating going out and it's like 10 people sitting around a table and everyone's, it's just, that type of thing is sort of fine when you're younger. But I think as one matures, it's not really something it's fine having a crowd at times, but there's a different need than when one is a kid and when you're an adult, And I think the same happens for people in recovery. You see it, people in 12-step meetings. In the beginning, they're sort of hanging around in big groups and buddies with everyone. And then as time goes by, their friendship circle becomes less and less until it comes down to a couple of people. Sometimes even one or two. And I think then it's fine because one can have those attachment needs met through one, two, or three or four people. It doesn't have to be, an NA meeting of 30 people or a group of people or 12 people. But in the beginning, what some people have pointed out is that what is useful for addicts in the beginning is to have a group. Especially a group that has got sort of some higher ideology, is that because of most addicts' narcissistic wounding, they have a very tough time making individual connections. And also their narcissism would be so fragile in a way that there's a very good chance, like, you know, if their recovery consisted of making one friendship in the beginning, there's a very good chance in the first 6 months or a year that they would have a serious fallout with this person and not be able to mend it or amend it in a way that it becomes sustainable. They would just break up their friendship. Because for whatever reason, the levels of immaturity that one has. So a group of people serves a function that is difficult to break up with a group of people or have a fallout with everyone in the group. And because one is also projecting one's narcissistic needs onto the group as a whole, which is more difficult to be let down by than just one person. But as one matures, then one develops the capacity to actually form these individual bonds that aren't that prone to a sort of, you know, just a sudden rapture, which is what people are prone to that suffer from narcissistic issues or borderline issues, and also people that are immature. You know, it's difficult for them to sustain individual friendships. So for many people, while they work through these sort of primitive or archaic attachment issues, the group still functions as the sort of container and as a support system until they develop the capacity to form these long-term relationships with individual people.
Makes sense.
And Victoria, for yourself?
Yeah, I'm just listening and contemplating, but that what you're saying certainly makes a lot of sense, that there is that need for, well, first of all, I'm fascinated by the whole idea of the shame coming out of early attachment disorders. That makes a great deal of sense to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look at it from that perspective, then so much of this does fit. And the reality that, for instance, romantic relationships established early on in recovery just can't be sustained because there isn't the maturity to be able to do that.
Absolutely.
The narcissism is so great. I guess part of what I'm wondering about, it is often so difficult for people to find places to establish the kind of relationships that you're talking about outside of 12-step groups.
Sure.
For those who just, for one reason or another, aren't willing, or some who go to 12-step groups but also need more support than that, or would like to have different kinds of friendships, different groups of friends. You were talking about how shallow the cultures tend to be, and it's really true. Where do people go to find just to relate on a deeper level?
Absolutely. I've got a quote here in front of me which I like to read to you guys, which sums it up quite beautifully, written by a guy called Luigi Zoggia, which is he was a Jungian analyst that wrote an incredible book about it on addiction, one of my top favorite books of all time on addiction, called Addiction and Ritual or something like that. But I'll just read the quote here and then we can expand on that. He basically says, drug addiction is not, as generally believed, an escape from society, but a desperate attempt to occupy a place in it. Insofar as the addict perceives that his family resolves hypnotically around him, and that society is judging his behavior as an attack on civil unity, you always remain the, I don't know what this word is, like homo euconymous, while playing out his societal role as the negative hero. It's almost impossible for many young people to feel in any way useful in today's society. Why should we be so amazed that so many take drugs? And why should we interpret addiction as a regressive renunciation of the ego when the person making the choice is actually seeking a few moments of heroic identity? The archaic necessity of identifying both heroes and enemies concentrated in the addict's creeping sensation of living a kind of civil war between a minor faction made up of angels of death and a stronger majority law-abiding citizens, the latter, however, seems to lack any identity of their own. So that's quite a powerful quote to me, and there's obviously a lot in there. But what by the way, the book's called Drug Addiction Initiation, The Modern Search for Ritual, which I think is one of the best books ever written on the lower left quadrant.
Would you say that one more time, Guy? Drug addiction and what?
And initiation.
And the author is Luigi
Zogia.
Z-O-J-A.
Z-O-J-A.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah.
So well, like, if you'd be willing to send that to us, I would really appreciate it. That's amazing.
Yeah. I'll put it in the little dialogue box here. Yeah, it's a great. I mean, the thing, you know, especially the last line is the archaic necessity of identifying both heroes and enemies concentrates in the addict's creeping cessation, living a kind of civil war between a minority faction made up of angels of death and a stronger majority law-abiding citizens, and then the latter seems to lack any identity of their own. And I think that's a very powerful thing. And I think for addicts that, you know, come out of addiction, especially sort of culturally enmeshed addicts, you know, let's take the example of a heroin addict. You know, you've been living with these people, the relationships that you formed with them are literally blood ties. You know, most heroin addicts actually use each other's syringes with their blood in it. You know, I mean, you literally spiking somebody else's blood. That's why people get HIV. Now, that's a pretty intimate thing to do, if you think about it. You know, most people in the normal world don't really exchange blood. Now, that's just a physical thing, but it obviously indicates something much, much more deeper. The risk that these people take, the danger that they put themselves in, and this is all done alongside other people, you know, whether it's sort of criminal stuff or just detoxing together, the type of bonds that form in these type of relationships, it's like, you know, that's why you see guys that, you know, look at these old guys from the Second World War. Every year they go to their little ritual thing for their battalion, wear their uniform and their suits, and still put roses on the graves of people that died 40 years ago, or more than 40 years ago. It's like, what, 60 years ago or something. And these are only people that most of them knew for maybe a couple of weeks or like a year. You know, these aren't people they grew up with from when they were kids. But that, the bond that people form in such extreme conditions, you know, when you're sitting there and you've got the Luftwaffe shooting, you know, dropping bombs on you, and you and your buddy are sitting in a trench and shooting machine guns at you, is very different sitting in a chess club and talking about, you know, chess moves or something. Or, you know, I don't know what normal people do for these type of things. You know, most other societies, it's virtually impossible to form that type of bond in most social environments. So for somebody that comes out of that type of environment, you know, whether these bonds were healthy or not is not necessarily the point. The point is that they're very strong, you know. Whether they you know, bad for one is irrelevant. It's just that they're very powerful and they're very intense. And in many ways that's the type of bond that most addicts would look for when they enter treatment. And as you guys said, you know, where do you find that in the world, really? And you know, I'm not saying that the 12 steps is the only place that provides that. I think any group of addicts that get together, that form any type of fellowship could provide a very similar phenomenological experience for a person. But there is something about people connecting that have shared that level of sort of trauma or PTSD or whatever you want to call it. And that's why most addiction fellowships tend to split up as well. For a crack addict sitting in a meeting listening to alcoholics talk about drinking whiskey the whole night, can be pretty dull, and won't provide him with that feeling of connection. And that's what happened with NA. You know, the addicts just weren't relating to the alcoholics in the early days, and they thought, well, let's form our own meeting. And then you have stuff like Cocaine Anonymous and Opiates Anonymous where the meetings become even more specialized. And now you have like lesbian cocaine meetings or something, you know. And I think, you know, there's a danger to all of the specialization, but I think the need behind that is to find a group of people that really uniquely share something that is a very significant aspect in your life.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm thinking about spiral dynamics on top of that, and it seems to me like there's a need, though, too, to evolve beyond the new identification as a recovering addict. Because what I saw in treatment and what I've seen in early recovery is just a duplication of those same kind of bonds they had on the street. And they're intense, and all of a sudden there's somebody they've known. There's five people that they've known for exactly 15 days in treatment, and those people are their best friends, and they're telling each other they love each other. And I understand that. It makes sense. It's much healthier to have those same kind of projections in a treatment center than on the street. But then to evolve out of that red zone, I eventually need to, like, at least it seemed to me, I needed to move out of the identification as an addict as well. I'm Lisa. I have been addicted to drugs. And to not re-addict myself, this is what I do. So it's sort of like, to me, there's a danger zone, too, of not having a navigator beyond the group itself to deal with all of those complex projections that go on in groups. So I see a lot of, I even heard Jane Velez Mitchell say on TV the other day that, why would anybody not go to treatment? 12-step groups are free. Well, in my experience, 12-step groups are not treatment. And I needed a navigator to help me learn to work with the projector, me, and not just have a relative support system in the projected, if that makes any sense. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. And, you know, like you're saying, that's developmental. I mean, the last thing that I would enjoy personally now is to go and sit with a bunch of heroin addicts that have just come on the street in a meeting. You know, I don't know if I find anything more dull. But that's because I've worked through those stages where in the early stages of my recovery, that is the only place where I would have felt any form of connection. You know, if I went to sit with a group of people that's 15 years clean talking about non-duality and, you know, becoming, you know, like productive members of society, or I'm working towards helping the universe evolve its consciousness through the collectiveness of the planet, I would have thought, I don't even know what these people were talking about. It would have sounded completely absurd to me.
That's sort of my point in that after being there for years and years and years, I was still hearing people with 10 and 20 years going, I can't trust my thinking. And I'm going, wait a minute. Like,
yeah.
That's not a message I'm okay with. That's not what's true for me. And so the opposite's just as true. I've seen quite a few people, and I'm not picking on 12-step groups. I'm pointing out groups in general where I could stagnate by taking on that persona of what's told to me early on, which is very helpful, and not moving beyond that. And I saw so much of it that I thought, I got to get away from here. This is killing me to believe this shit. This is just not okay with me. And so it was a horrible experience for me, but a very necessary one, because I hadn't done my inner work. I would have been okay with it probably if I had.
Yeah, exactly. And that's in many ways what the whole integral recovery is about. It's about acknowledging all those stages for people at that stages and not saying one is better than the other.
Yeah.
Because what would be good for one person at one stage would be really the worst possible thing for another person at that stage.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, there's always so much critique against 12 steps for being too much amber and too much this and too much that. I mean, the problem is that, you know, if your average addict walked into a meeting and everyone's talking about non-duality, it just wouldn't make sense to them, you know. So in many ways, the treatment, the level of consciousness needs to be accessible for the person that's entering it. And the same goes for somebody at a higher level of development. So what's going to work for somebody with 1 to 5 years or whatever clean, just by its nature, shouldn't work for somebody that's 10 years clean. And that's why I said it, that they, you know, for some people, staying in 12-step fellowships can actually be deleterious, because especially if the particular group that they belong to is overly dogmatic, because, you know, clearly what worked for you when you were a week clean or 2 weeks clean or a year clean, that, you know, if you're actually growing, then that same environment wouldn't nourish you. It's like being in the same grade for 10 years in a row.
So
any group of people that doesn't acknowledge development, one is gonna run the risk when one is part of that, of growing out of the culture, which Wilbur refers to as a sort of legitimation crisis, where in oneself, where the culture isn't really supporting one's own observations. It's like being, you know, it's like looking at the Earth from a spaceship and seeing it's round, but the culture is saying, listen, you know, the Earth is still flat. You know, it's not round. So it's all a matter of where one is developmentally and one's perspective, and where the group is developmentally and from a perspective. So vice versa. You know, I think 12 steps can be very useful, and then in some ways it becomes less useful for some person. The one thing about the 12 steps which I have to add, which a lot of people do, I think that's quite a good thing, is that for many people with long-term clean time, and I've met people like that that's 40 years clean, they still go to a lot of meetings, is, and it's not everyone, but the reason they go is that they've taken on the idea of service. So they don't go to meetings to get something from the meeting. They see a meeting as going there to give something to people that is at a lower level of consciousness. You know, it's like going and working with homeless people, giving them food and having a chat. You're not going there to get something from the person, or hearing some profound wisdom. One is going there to be of service. So, for a lot of the people that actually do stay on for a long time, tend to get that balance right. For a lot of people, stay there because they're just developmentally arrested as well. But I think for some people, like, one can actually stay in an environment that doesn't nourish one, but one can come from a place of service rather than from a place of, I need to relate to what's going on here.
Very true.
And the same goes for, the eye levels as well. I don't think service alone is going to work. I think one still needs some at least some group of people that can see where one is at. Otherwise, one can also think sort of take on the same complex or the land of the eye, land of the blind, one eyes king type of thing. So we haven't spoken much about the actual practice of what this means. But I think it's pretty self-evident from our conversation is really find a group of people that you're really comfortable with, that understands one to some extent, and that nourishes where one can form the type of connection that nourishes these needs. And I think what's also useful to see is that different groups of people and different people can also nourish certain needs. You know, some of my friends, I won't talk about my feelings to them about, but I find them intellectually very stimulating. And then some friend, I might speak about my feelings, but I'm not going to have a philosophical debate with them. So, you know, it's also getting what you need maybe from different people or different groups. And I think different groups can provide the same thing. One group can provide information. One group can just provide a sense of connection. And one group can provide, you know, something else.
I never thought about this until you started saying this, but the groups that I have nourish different quadrants. Like,
yeah.
I have my hiking club that I lead. That really nourishes, you know, initially and primarily present in a, you know, its first presentation is physical fitness and being out in nature and connecting with women and all that other stuff. And then my smart recovery group is directly, you know, community with other addicts and specifically lower left quadrant. My group that does the work of Byron Katie together every day, that's very much upper left quadrant, you know, self-inquiry. It's really, and then I have a group that meets every week. I don't always go, but it's for those of us who are developing businesses and small businesses, and that's my lower right quadrant group.
Yeah.
And I love them all. They all, like, you're so right. Like, my hiking group, we tend to just talk chick stuff. And the business group, we support each other to build our businesses. It's really interesting you mentioned that. But, yeah, groups for different quadrants really support the developmental spiral to happen.
Yeah, it's very difficult to get, you know, all these needs met for one particular group, apart from the integral recovery group that can satisfy one on all quadrants, all levels, all states, all types, and everything. Just joking, by the way. I don't think we can.
That's really true, though. Like, that's the one group I have that talks about it all.
Yeah.
Very cool.
But obviously, it's also limited in other ways. I think with the integral recovery thing is, I think with most integral things, one tends to get a bit too top heavy with it, and maybe not as emotionally supportive as other groups would be, which I think is just the nature of it. But I think like what you're doing with the integral recovery fellowship meeting, there is something that would very much speak, not so much. I don't think that meetings or fellowships will be so attractive because people want to sit and debate about, you know, what typology is more important or what is the relationship between states and types and all these things. But for people to have that just very basic emotional support with people that would understand them from a specific point of view, which is a sort of integral point of view. So I think even in integral groups, there can be actually different type of integral groups that help with different aspects of the whole thing, where maybe one group would be difficult to combine all the cognitive stuff that one has to work through with all the sort of emotional and just social needs.
Makes a lot of sense. The integral fellowship is more about experiential sharing of the individual and getting support from the group within the context of integral recovery, whereas like our Integral Recovery School is a little more cerebral.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Intellectual. Yeah. Cool. Makes sense. Well, we're getting all those bases covered, huh?
Absolutely.
Well, and it feels like that's the movement too, to cover more of the bases.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like you were saying earlier, Victoria, I think in a lot of these things, one starts off with the idea, and one sees that a lot of the integral world, you know, just starts off from theory and very cerebral stuff, and then there's a realization, or not a realization, just the next movement is forming a community around the idea, you know, like you were saying earlier, which is possibly happening more collectively as well in the world, that without the community to sustain that, whatever it is, it's just not gonna be sustainable.
Right.
Hey, before we check out, this is a total change of subject, but SoundsTrue.com has 75% off on CD and audio downloads of Helen Palmer's Enneagram and Ken Wilber's Cosmic Consciousness, as well as a bunch of other stuff. But I just wanted to let people know it's only 24 more hours, and it's 75% off to get the Enneagram and Cosmic Consciousness on SoundsTrue.com.
Okay.
Thanks, Martha.
That Cosmic Consciousness is pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm downloading it later tonight when I get my internet back. I bought it. I just got to wait till I have internet. But I'm excited to listen to that on my headphones. I do my run. I always need something to listen to.
Yeah, that's great. One actually understands what Wilbur is saying when he speaks on that.
Yeah, he's a smart man.
Well, I think we've come to the end. Thanks, guys. Thanks for an engaging dialogue.
Thank you very much. It has been.
Yep. All right, everybody. Well,
bye. Until next time.
Until Friday, I hope.
And any of you that can make it Wednesday night, I'll see you then.
Oh, good, yep. Lisa. Okay, bye. Thanks, Guy. That was great.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
See you soon.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.